Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
A few weeks ago, someone asked me, "What are you doing with the turkey this year?" And I should have said something interesting like, "Well, I'm doing it the traditional way. Going to slather it in bog butter, like our ancestors might have done fado, and slow cook it from sunrise to sunset on a hill over a pit fire of Irish oak, smoked with tato crisps and Christmas editions of the Ireland's Own." But my answer was much simpler. This year I said, I will maybe cook it. Christmas traditions aren't set in stone. They change as our lives change. When I was young, Christmas Day was just the three of us at home in Uri. And sometimes the uncle, the priest, would come. And he once brought a bottle of some fancy liqueur that a parishioner had given him. And he poured me a measure at the dining room table before the dinner arrived. I was 17 years and 2 months old. My pioneer pledge had gone up in smoke a good few years before, secretly and spectacularly. But I still had to do that pretend thing of surprise and, wow, alcohol for me. And as I sipped the amber, malty, creamy, strong liqueur in the living room, my mother, from through the wall in the kitchen, sensed that something was up, the way mothers do, and roared, "Not to be giving me drink and turning me into an alcoholic." And after she died, the Christmas routine changed. I'd go pick up my dad in Uri, then back up to our house in Saintfield, County Down, give him the dinner, leave him back to Uri, fed and watered, and then drive to the in-laws in Derry, where the party was in full swing. There was your choice of comfy armchair and a fire to fall asleep in front of, which I usually did after 270 miles of driving on Christmas Day. Now the parents are gone, the in-laws are gone too, so the Christmas routine is different again. No driving to Derry or Newry. It's just the five of us at home for the day in Saintfield. But the Belgian cousins come to us now. And that's the new tradition. Christmas Eve, sing song till very late. Over to our neighbour Lorna's, Christmas morning, lots of nibbles, drinks, and chat. And I'll nip home occasionally to check on Terry. Terry's the turkey. And last year we had 12 people, so Terry was a beast, the size of a small child. I never cook the turkey on Christmas Eve, and here's why. Because I know of two sons who went out and had too much to drink on Christmas Eve. They came home to find that their mother had gone to bed. There was a lovely aroma of Christmas in the house because she'd cooked the turkey and left it cooked and covered in foil on the sideboard, ready for the next day. And beside the bird, their old father, out for the count, having had a wee toot and fallen asleep in his favourite chair. So the boys decided to have a nibble, just at one leg of the turkey, just a bit of a leg at first, and then the other leg. But it was tasty and warm, and it had a belly full of beer, and they picked at it till a lot of the bird was gone. But then, in a move worthy of international criminal masterminds, they took an eaten drumstick, wiped it round the lips of their sleeping father, and gently pressed it into his hand, and went off to bed. So when the poor father woke the next morning, there was a drumstick in his hand, the bird was eaten, and although he had no memory of eating it, he could taste turkey off his lips. No further questions, Your Honor. And every year for 15 years, the mother would berate him as they sat down on Christmas Day with, "Well, at least we have a turkey to eat this Christmas." And no, the brothers never admitted their crime. So last year I cooked the ham on Christmas Eve, hid it, Didn't cook our turkey the night before, but I checked the cooking time, planned my prep around it, went about our Christmas day, over to Lorna's, nibbles, drinks and chat, popped back, checked the dinner, all good. And then about 4 o'clock, all was done, and I gathered everybody back round the kitchen table, made sure they all had a seat, the ham was ready, spuds were done, crackers on the table, and the veg looked good. And Terry the turkey was fine. On mature reflection, he might have looked a bit pale, but I took the tin foil off and thought, that'll brown it up a bit. I didn't actually poke Terry until a few minutes later when I discovered, to my horror, that despite being in there for the right number of hours and a bit more, Terry the turkey was as pink as Barbie's sofa. I now understand that our oven has two settings. One called Serco Roast and the other called Serco Therm. Serco Roast, according to the brochure, and I quote, is ideal for cooking large pieces of meat or whole fish and can result in crispy skin and a rotisserie flavour. Sounds like the one for the Christmas turkey. But then so does Serco Therm, which lets you, and I quote again, cook and bake on up to 3 levels with perfectly even results. And who amongst us does not love perfectly even results? To be fair, Terry was perfectly evenly pink and evenly raw the whole way through. There is a moment when only you know that a bad thing has happened. And even though in the great scheme of your life, you know, the world will keep on turning, you still have to say that thing out loud. Say the words out loud in front of these lovely people who have come to your house to get fed on this, the most special and most emotionally loaded family day of the whole year. Big breath. I'm sorry, everybody, but it looks like the turkey hasn't cooked for some reason and it won't be ready. No, I'm not joking. But we've got ham and spuds and veg and everything else. No, it's not a joke. And sure, aren't we all here together and happy and healthy? Thank God. No, I'm serious. And it's great to see you all. But your mind, not to mention your wife, is telling you, you had one job. And eventually we laughed. Eventually. We had roasties, carrots, sprouts, lovely gravy. Lots of roast ham and trifle and Christmas pudding for afters. And the next day and for a few days after, we had the most succulent, slow-cooked, very slow-cooked turkey. And you know what? Nobody died. In other news, for my birthday earlier this year, I got from my lovely family an instant read digital food thermometer. So may your chestnuts roast perfectly, evenly, and thoroughly on your open fire this Christmas.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Jack Frost nipping at your nose. Yuletide carols being sung by a choir. And folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows.
Actually, before I read this, I wish my mother a happy birthday. She's in the crowd somewhere tonight. She's 21 today. Hardly care enough. 50 years gone. The public houses of this city are a little busier at this time of the year. The seasoned regulars saunter off the stage, or stumble off the stage, awaiting your dry January before returning to the high stool. The 12 pubs of Christmas means absolutely nothing to them. They just want their one back. And in such busy spaces, the decorative features and the framed artworks in the pub are harder to see. But if you look hard enough in Peter's Pub and Davy Burns, the Palace Bar and elsewhere, the work of Harry Carnoff is still there. Some of these paintings have hung on the same nails since his day. And 50 years ago, on Christmas Day, 1974, this great chronicler of Dublin in paint and woodcut died. In May of that same year, one Dublin newspaper told their readers that Harry Carnoff has for 50 years wandered around Dublin, recording its landmarks and characters, and is as well known to the citizens of Dublin as the statues in O'Connell Street. And for someone who so loved Dublin and its people, Carnoff was not a typical Dubliner. Born in 1900 in London, Harry was part of Dublin's small but influential Jewish community and the son of a Russian-born furniture maker. From an apprenticeship with his father, he honed the skills that would later produce immediately recognisable woodcuts of the city. In the streets around the South Circular Road, Portobello and Clonbrassil Street, Dublin's Little Jerusalem was home to many families like Harry Carnoff's. One resident remembered Clonbrassil Street as the kosher street. And those who visited the street in the early 20th century, Ray Rivlin recalled in her History of the Community, were transported to scenes more in keeping with 19th century Russia than 20th century Ireland. On Christmas Day, the shops were all open. Carnoff worked from a studio in Portobello, today marked by a plaque, part of the landscape of remembrance of Jewish Dublin. And though he was an accomplished landscape painter, I think what has really held his place in the memory of Dublin are his depictions of us, the denizens of the city, many of whom set for him in his studio. It's a who's who of Dublin cultural and literary life. You know, familiar are his depictions of men like Miles na gCapaillín, otherwise Brian O'Nulan, otherwise Flann O'Brien, otherwise George Knowall, or whatever name he was going by on one particular day, Brendan Behan, Liam O'Flaherty, but more overlooked are characters like Ria Mooney, the first female producer at the Abbey Theatre, who had withstood the 1926 riots at the Plough and the Stars. Artistic cliques do not interest him, one profile of Harry noticed, but the people with whom he comes into daily contact do. There are rabbis, journalists, stage managers, barmen, street characters. Of the latter, there could be no greater example than the Toucher Doyle. Only in Dublin do you get a great nickname like that. Who was said to have obtained such an illustrious nickname when he touched King Edward for a fiver at the Leopardstown races. Touching was considered different from begging. This was a promised loan, likely never to be seen again. He touched me for 10 bob while I was painting him, remembered Harry Carnoff, but it was done with real artistry. We see the Toucher Doyle holding a pint he presumably didn't pay for, in a bird never flew on one wing, one of Carnoff's most instantly recognisable works. The pub, the public house, was not merely a place of social recreation, but a world within itself to Harry Carnoff. There were no shortage of artists within that world. MacDade's proximity to the Grafton Street studio of the artist Desmond McNamara is what established it as a literary pub in the first place. And this was a world that had its own tensions. The MacDade's world, John McGahern insisted privately, it's such a jungle, it's impossible. But Carnoff viewed the pub as a subject that he wanted to capture. And a particularly beloved work, one of my favourite artworks, hangs in the National Gallery of Ireland. It's a view of Davy Burns' Moral Pub from the Bailey across the street. The work is brilliant for its playfulness. Carnoff, instantly recognisable in his distinctive hat, put himself in it. We see him in the mirror. And amidst the bottles of stout and wine and the spirits, there are two theatre posters on the wall. Look at the Heffernans in the Abbey, Romeo and Juliet at the Gay Theatre. Comedy and tragedy, together as always. A political radical, Kernoff's work also appears in surprising places, you know, the mastheads of socialist and communist newspapers. But his politics can come true in the work as well. And the painter Michael Caine, in his memoir, Blind Dogs, he remembers Harry as a cheery little man who one sometimes encountered hurrying across Stephen's Green with his briefcase on his way to meet a client. But what Caine remembers is so important, if you want to understand Harry Kernoff, is the vision of the work. He says, it's sunny day socialism all the way. And if the ordinary people were not at the hustings, they were having fun at the seaside or enjoying a day in the country. On Christmas Day, 1974, Dublin's public houses were shut and no glass was raised to Harry Kernoff's name. But the finest commemoration has been to do exactly what many of these public houses have done, leave the work where it is. And who would dare to move the Tutcher Doyle from its vantage point in Nereus or the Palace? Thank you.
My sisters are here, bad sisters, and Beth. So thanks, guys, and it's just wonderful to see you all. Right, this is called Deck the Halls. The school gates had closed, and it was beginning to dawn on me. 2 weeks and 3 days, that's 17 days. 17 days to try to think up stuff to do with the two angels I am lucky enough to call my children. It would be lovely to spend time together for the first few hours. But 17 days. It wasn't clear what we were going to do for that long. We could make Christmas biscuits again until icing sugar had coated every surface and stuck the soles of our shoes to the floor of the pokey little kitchen that we're lucky enough to be renting. We could play Uno constantly, or we could take out that 1,000-piece Winter Wonderland puzzle for a third year running and lose a few more pieces and then put it back in its box. Libraries are shut, playgrounds are bleak social outposts. Ice skating hadn't really worked out that time, don't ask. And everyone we knew was retreating home to their families. We could go and see Santa, suggested the 7-year-old, and I shook my head because we don't do that. Santa lives very far away, I explained, and he's already getting you loads of presents. But you can get more, said the 7-year-old, who is always sunny in his nature and hopeful. And his sister, age 2, looked up from her pram with interest. We weren't sure what to do about the Christmas holiday situation. Some people this time of year are very organized and pack their calendars with plans while wrapping presents and maybe buying matching pajamas. I'm not one of them. Christmas hasn't been the same since the breakup of my family into two houses a few years ago, and I haven't relished the arrival of a season that requires me to carry both a Christmas tree and a 2-year-old in from the car on a sleety night, and then find a suitable corner in our already clustered living space to stand the tree upright, and then summon the enthusiasm to hang it with baubles from our halved box of decorations, and then disentangle the giant thorny ball of fairy lights to see if there are any working sets left inside this abomination. 17 days stretched ahead of us like a snowscape with no clear path to follow. And it is, let me stress, so lovely to spend time together. I just never thought Christmas would look like this. I suppose it hasn't been the same either without my mother and father. That first year without either of them, all civilization was left to ruin as my sister Grace and I bashed incompetently around her kitchen, realizing we had none of our mum's recipes or her natural good humor or our father's tolerance or his rare table-setting talents. Because he was a father who, when things got a little hot in the kitchen, would quietly put on his coat and crunch across the grass with clippers to look for holly with berries on it to lay across the table. And there was that other Christmas, which he spent inside a manhole, unblocking a drain, without complaining. But that's another story. I've often asked myself, is the magic of childhood a symptom of being horribly spoilt? How is everything so fantastic? I used to wonder as I sat daydreaming in class about Christmas morning. Candy canes and white chocolate mice and scratch cards, clementines and tiny doll's toys wrapped in pink tissue paper at the bottom of stockings that were misshapen with loot. And how was it that when my parents bought my brother a snooker table, Santa had the genius to buy him snooker balls? There were croissants on the breakfast table, cranberry sauce bubbling on the hob, the radio was on and Shane McGowan was singing, and it was actually a fairy tale. Now it seemed more like a mild penal servitude. 2 weeks and 3 days, 17 days in hard weather, the rain did not hold off, the ceiling was getting lower, and the walls I had festooned with decorations began closing in. So it was without much festive cheer that I wrapped up the two cherubs and belted them into the back of the car to get to the appointment with Santa Claus. Because the seven-year-old had won, and we were driving out of Dublin. The hills were dark, rain speared the windowpane, and the two-year-old screamed for crisps for miles along the N11. And it was in a flurry of humbug and swear words that I unloaded everyone and everything from the car and queued to get into the Santa experience. The seven-year-old, sporting a jumper covered in snowmen and reindeer, was steeled for anything. So we made our way along the fake snow to join our group of festively dressed children and adults in flashing musical jumpers. Then boarded a red train wrapped in evergreen and tinsel, bound, it said, for the North Pole. The train took us to a plastic igloo where a very glamorous Mrs. Claus in red velvet robes, a wig and falsies got the children making Christmas crafts. Their faces had by now filled with quiet awe. Two young sea captains wearing tightly fitted suits, covered in gingerbread men, then led a dance routine to Santa Claus is Coming to Town. And I was beginning to actually surrender to the whole thing as well. As they steered us across a light-spangled lagoon to Santa's grotto, one of the sea captains was being so convincingly joyous that I almost wished I hadn't asked him, "What's your 9 to 5? "Lifeguard," he told me in a strong Wicklow accent. "Seasonal work, though, a bit of this and a bit of that, you know yourself." But the spell was unbroken for the children, and watching them gaze in wonder at this festive ensemble, I could only sink further into the snowy daydream. Music jingled, sea captains in gingerbread suits danced, elves flung presents at us. I had never imagined finding peace in a place like this, but here it was.
That Christmas in the mid-70s was the first time the five of us siblings were together as adults. My three brothers and my sister had all emigrated to London as youngsters in the 60s. I, the youngest by well over a decade, grew up as an only child, the only one who wasn't forced to take the boat. The excitement was palpable in our house as each one of them arrived home in turn that Christmas in Jimmy Costigan's hackney car. My mother and I did not conceal our expectations as suitcases were opened and the booty handed over. She had asked for an unusual present, a set of candlesticks. The prized object was protected in rolled-up clothing and presented with solemnity. A few candle stubs were swiftly removed from jam pots and placed regally in the new holder, a silver-plated one with three intertwining arms. For the first time in many years, all seven of us were to gather around the Christmas table. Food and drink would be required, far more than could be carried in message bags on the handlebars of bicycles. Transport was needed. A car would be hired for the shopping expedition. We were, after all, people who planned to sit around a table lit by the soft flicker of candles in a candelabrum. My brother Michael could drive. He showed us photographs of the little car he had in London. A Triumph Herald. We marvelled at his prowess and so looked forward to travelling in a car driven by one of our own. And so the powder blue Ford Anglia was rented from the augustly named Care House Garage to us, Bourke's Garage in the square. Trips to the big shops in Clonmel occurred very rarely. My father had cycled the 20-mile round trip once to buy a blade for the scythe. Sometimes we travelled to Clonmel by bus to buy a few sticks of furniture from a second-hand shop run by an Italian, a Mr. Carey. I often bought a comic for the journey home from a huckster shop near the bus station. But we'd have no paltry truck with huckster shops today. Today, we'd load our goods into a supermarket trolley. We were bursting with the expansiveness of our expedition. We piled gatto cakes and Lucozade, tins of Mikado biscuits and peaches into the trolley with a kind of wild abandon. We were intoxicated by the rare wonder of being together, flush with the saved-up emigrant shillings and the grandeur of a car in the car park to ferry us home. We were just about to leave the supermarket with our bulging shopping bags when we spotted the shabby-looking, unshaven man at the checkout. Here we were with our seasonal plenty, and there he was, a couple of days shy of Christmas, and all he was buying was a small loaf and a half dozen eggs. He couldn't have less, my brother Patsy declared, identifying closely with the underdog he now described as a poor devil. Poor man's shopping, I chimed in, as we further decried the lowly state of our fellow customer. We concluded that the world's goods were badly and unfairly divided. We also decided, in swift and energetic unison, that we'd redress the balance that day for that one individual. Wait here for a minute, we instructed the bemused stranger. My sister minded our bags and detained the man with simple chat about Christmas. Meanwhile, the rest of us flew around the supermarket aisles, filling a couple of baskets with choice fare. We made collective decisions about what he'd like to eat. He looked like a rasher and sausage man, we declared, as we threw in the best galty bacon. He'd need cheese and cold meat for sandwiches. The basics were a foregone conclusion. Tea, sugar, bread and butter. And what would Christmas be for him without a few bottles of stout? We decided as we ventured into the off-license section, swift as customers who had won a trolley dash. We waved away the man's confused questions as we handed over the bag of groceries to him. Who are these from? He asked. Who are you? We're just a family, I said, in the regal and lofty tones of the magnanimous. The food is a gift from us. I spoke as one from a strong dynasty, duty bound to be benevolent to the less fortunate. We exuded the glow of the righteous as we loaded our shopping into the boot of the hired Anglia. We had practiced a random act of kindness. We had stood in solidarity with a poor man. We had acted out of a pure and spontaneous impulse to do good. It was a jaw-dropping moment when he sped past us in his smart Jeep. Tooting the horn at us and waving... waving in a confused way. We looked at one another in bewilderment, decided that appearances can be deceptive. And that maybe our father was right when he warned us to never let anyone take us for idiots. And that included ourselves.
Wenceslas looked out on the feast of Stephen, when the slowly round about, deep and crisp and even, brightly shone the moon that night, though the frost was cruel, when a poor man came in sight, gathering winter fuel.
The annals would have told us that there were animal smells, horned cattle, lumpen ewes. There would have been the sweat of labour, soft cries of accepted pain, the sensible music of tenderness and love, and the scent of night jasmine, perhaps the triumphant hoot of the tawny owl under the white, unflickering stars. In a painting of the stable, the crib, Giotto has the infant child, newly born, being held in human hands. He is naked, being bathed, and the artist would have us know that this is the God, the creator of the cosmos, giving himself over into the care of human beings. This is the child, flung by the waves of eternity up onto a stone-shocked shore. The French composer Olivier Messiaen will see this moment as the beginning of an incredible exchange. The one who is divine exchanging divinity for the dangers and sufferings of human living, and offering in exchange that humanity, that lumpen mortal species, the opportunity to win divinity. One who is often overlooked in the great images and discussions of the Nativity is Joseph, Yosef, the husband of Mary, Miriam. I see him firstly stunned by wonder and awe at the human child, Jesus, Yeshua. Those baby fingers, marvels of perfection, cuticle and lunula, wafer delicate as the white moth's wing. Cosmic, too, with universe upon universe depending, wrinkled like walnut skin, thoroughly beautiful, though without beauty, this swaddle-swathed detainee of Earth. Joseph would have been very conscious of the dangers in the world at that time, as, sadly, the world now and in our time. With the Roman occupation, the sense of war, for he was wondering how to protect him, this child, from Herod and Caesar and tyrant, from the common avarice, the luxury, the urge to empire. His new boy child, just born, to be held tenderly in a world suffering the tyranny of untruths, wars abroad, and the body politic at ruck in bad faith. And Joseph, Yeshua, who is he then? A seasoned, broad-chested, working man, wholly dependable, taking the place of the everlasting Yahweh God from everlasting to everlasting. I see him, this young, new father, Joseph, coming outside that night to sit back against the side wall, his head in his hands, shaking. It is the ordinary, the most beautiful and impossible wonder of our world, this, the birth of a child. Now he promises to teach him the names of God, Yahweh and El Shaddai, Elohim of wine and bread, heart's ease, heartache, majesty and squalor. For this is familiar townland where neighbor knows neighbor, and everyone can tell how the first child takes all of your life, fastens it tight in its soft flesh fists. In the annals of my own life, I recall one Christmas night, starlight on the island road, and behind a hedge, the churring song of a nightjar, that secretive, night hiding in night, great bird. And I knew that the music within the human spirit is unheard until it is played. And even the angels who bear you up cannot avert the dangers and the suffering ahead. Flesh and matter, things of blood and skin and tissue. And as the night of the incarnation turned to a slow dawn light, coming soft as dewfall over the earth, where Joseph sat and waited, he could hear outside the birthplace a grasshopper begin its morning cheer, cheer, cheer out there, invisible amongst the grasses. And soon he would hear the creaking of the olive press, the grinding of the millstone, the ordinary sounds of a familiar townland. Although we know that the world had changed utterly, an impossible beauty had transformed the whole of creation that night, and nothing would ever be quite the same again. Joseph, Yosef, sits in the warming light of a new day, in the scent of lemon blossom, and thinks quietly of the demanding happiness of his loves, the child asleep in his own depths and snoring softly, and a woman, young in tenderness and old in wisdom. And he knows the overwhelming wonder of being alive and the stilled certainties of loneliness and of being loved. He gets up, goes back inside the birthing place, and great words of affection and hope are spoken over the child, falling drop upon drop, slow, slow, like a note recurrent on the white key of a grand piano. Let us inquire, then, of the horned beasts of the world, and they, with their great wide open eyes, will inquire of you, what, then, shall this child be?
The falcon flew from dark to dark, drew silver from the northern star, and headed for the crinkled hills, the rivers, lakes, and waterfalls, to find the source of light on earth, the source of light on earth. And as three weary pilgrim kings looked up and saw his glittering wings, the falcon saw a darkened town, a stable glowing like a crown, and knew that he had found the truth, that he had found the truth. The falcon hovered like a star, his wings spun out a spirit fire that drew the kings inside the shed. The child asleep in his straw bed was dreaming of a silver bird, was dreaming of a bird. His task now done, the falcon rose, a spark ablaze with joyful news. He lit the stars, he lit the moon, then vanished in the arc of sun that dawned beyond the Southern Cross, beyond the Southern Cross. Thank you.
On this morning's programme, featuring recordings from Christmas Miscellany at the National Concert Hall with the RTE Concert Orchestra and special guests conducted by Stephen Bell, and archive from the same event in recent years with conductor David Brophy, we heard Terry the Turkey by John Toll, Harry Kernoff, 50 Years Gone by Donal Fallon, Deck the Halls was by Maggie Armstrong, A Gift from the Family by Margaret Galvin, That Night by John F. Dean, and The Falcon Carol, a poem by James Harper. The music was The Christmas Song by Mel Torme, performed by Cormac Kinnevy and the RTE Concert Orchestra. The arrangement was by Jim Doherty. I'm a Man You Don't Meet Every Day, performed by Cate O'Riordan. The arrangement for orchestra was by Paul Frost. Rocking Around the Christmas Tree, composed by Johnny Marks and arranged by Roderick Dunk. The singer was, again, Cormac Kinnevy. And the conductor on those performances was Stephen Bell. Then we heard Good King Wenceslas, performed by John Molloy with the RTE Concert Orchestra. That was recorded in the National Opera House in Wexford last year, as was Margaret Galvin's script. And The Wexford Carol, sung by Sarah Shine, with an arrangement for orchestra by Damien Gallagher. And that was recorded in the NCH last year. And the conductor for those two latter performances was David Brophy. On sound were Pather Carney and James Feeney. And Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.